We'll get going, folks. I went through. Yeah. Ms. Edelman and Director Emke, if you want to come down, that would be great. Folks, we're going to do the zoo first. I think we'll do their financial presentation first, and then are we going to get entertained by the animals and birds? Actually, or how do we want to do it?
Mr. Chair,
go ahead. Introduce yourself and bring us through the show.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director of the Minnesota Zoo. With me here this morning is Peggy Adelman, our CFO. And there are also four other guests. We have Jim Guerrero, one of our 800 volunteers at the Minnesota Zoo, who is accompanied by a chinchilla from our Zoomobile program. And on my left is Christine Ness, who's a Zoomobile naturalist with a great horned owl. And I think I'd ask Christine to talk a bit about the owl and the Zoomobile program.
You know what? If you could come down by Ms. Edelman, introduce yourself for the record. Tell us what you do at the zoo, and then you'd be able to talk. Does that work with the owl, or if you'd rather be at the table here? Oh, is this in case he goes? Oh, interesting. So if
it's
you could tell us.
It's just a matter of time.
Your name and who you represent?
My name is Christine Ness, and I'm with the Zoomobile program at the Minnesota Zoo. We are the traveling naturalists, so we go everywhere from Baudette down to Albert Lea, War Road, Browns Valley, pretty much anywhere within the border of the state we travel. And this is one of our education animals that travels with us. We have about 80 different animals that travel the state with us.
And the animal that you have with us is what?
This is a great horned owl, and she is pretty much great horned owls are our biggest year-round full-time owl resident in the state of Minnesota. And she is 28 years old.
28 years old, and, yep. And you and I had a conversation. I believe we had one of those living in our residential neighborhood in Hastings where I was, because we had a little woodlot in the back there, and it tended to perch in the large trees there quite a bit and was there for years and years, it seemed.
Yeah, pretty much wherever they'll find mice, they'll show up. So they're here in the cities as well as the country and the open plains as well. So.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yep. And then Jim has one of our chinchillas, which is an animal that you guys might see in a pet store a lot, but what we use the chinchillas for, not only are they good at the children's hospitals and daycares and things like that, wild chinchillas are actually one of the most endangered mammals on the planet. There's only about 3,000 to 3,500 wild chinchillas left. And so when we do outreach, we can talk about endangered species with an animal that they see probably pretty regularly in pet stores.
And the zoo not only is there for members to come and visit and families, and we were just recently out there and had a great time with my granddaughter, you also do serve a research an endangered animal species role somewhat.
Mr. Chair.
Do you want to deal with that, Mr. Emke, when we get into that part?
Yeah,
I just thought we could hear from a real... No. No, that's good. Thank you. We appreciate you both being here. And unfortunately, now you're going to have to find a way to sign the record book while holding on to that owl. Welcome, Mr. Emke. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we thought it was a great opportunity to bring some warm and fuzzy to the committee this morning, because I'm sure you're not having a lot of it this year with the tough situation. The zoo, we were here a couple of weeks ago to present an overview of our agency, what the zoo does, and so I'm not going to reiterate that. The focus today is on our budget. But I did want to review a couple of the key points that I was able to make at the last.
Mr. Emke, I'm going to let members know we're going to work out of the budget book. Zoological Gardens is where we'll be at. And for the and there are extra copies if you happen to not have your book. And there will be copies at the table for anybody in the audience. So go ahead, Mr. Emke.
Okay. Some of the points that I made at our overview a few weeks ago, I think the most important is that the zoo is the state's largest environmental education center in terms of number of guests served. And we increasingly have a focus not just on showing people animals, but on what everyone's been referring to as STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. And we think, we believe our education programs are really helping to fill a gap, a growing gap in the school system, and really serving as a gateway to science and technology education. We see the increasing importance of out-of-school learning, and the zoo has excelled at providing informal and formal education at our venue for many years. We're also one of Minnesota's top attractions. In the last 3 years, we've drawn over 1.2 million people each year, the three best years in the history of the zoo, and we're generating over $114 million in direct and indirect economic benefit for the state. And I think it's notable that in this period of economic downturn, the last few years, our economic impact has grown significantly. For those of you who were around 10 years ago, I think you probably all remember that at that point, the legislature and the governor at the time really challenged the zoo to improve our performance. And I'm here 10 years later to say that we believe we've met and exceeded that challenge. Today, only 29% of our operating budget comes from the state. That's down from 60% in the past. And we're doing that by operating as a business, albeit it's a business with a strong mission focus on education and conservation. But we've found ways to continually improve our efficiency and our effectiveness. We've expanded the zoo significantly in the last 10 years. That's allowed for the attendance growth. But at the same time, our FTE growth, the number of employees at the zoo, although it's increased somewhat, the growth of increase in our employees is significantly lower than the growth of our attendance, our earned revenue, or our contributed revenue. And today, only 42% of our FTE count of 231 are actually funded out of the general fund account, and the rest are funded out of earned revenue and grants that we receive through our foundation. Over the last few years, we've aggressively pursued energy efficiencies, water use reduction, and operational practices that conserve resources and lower costs. Our annual operating support from our partner, we have a 501c3 partner, the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, has actually doubled over the last 4 years. It used to be an average of slightly under $1 million a year coming to the zoo. Today, it's over $1.9 million in operating support for the state agency. And in addition to that support, the foundation has raised millions of dollars for capital projects and strategic plan initiatives. We're very careful with each new addition to the zoo. We're very thorough, and we do a pro forma cost-benefit analysis. We want to make sure that we're never over-promising in terms of the results. And I think our track record has been very good, especially with some of the bigger investments like Russia's Grizzly Coast, which opened back in 2008. But we also are doing incremental, smaller improvements at the zoo, and at times we make some pretty tough decisions about where our operating support goes. Last year we opened a new exhibit in our tropics building called Faces of the African Forest. It was a much needed improvement, but we realized it probably didn't have attendance driving potential, so we actually at that point made the decision to close other exhibits at the zoo in order to not have a net increase in our operating gain. So, although we're a state agency and although we're a mission-driven organization, we operate as a business. So with that bit of background, I want to address the budget proposals that you're considering today. First of all, the governor's proposed budget recommends a reduction to our general fund appropriation of $312,000 a year, which represents about a 5% decrease in the current level. We would address this reduction in part through increasing our admission fees and our membership rates. These were increases we were already planning as a result of some new exhibits and new facilities that we'll be adding this year. And the increase has, in fact, been approved by the zoo board. But we'd also be looking to reduce expenses, in part by not opening our seasonal butterfly exhibit this summer. Now, we know that the loss of the butterfly exhibit, which is a real favorite of our guests, will be noticed, but we also know that this summer we'll be opening a major new penguin exhibit, the new Target Learning Center, which will have many performances, and we're confident that we're going to be providing an overall guest experience commensurate with the adjusted pricing structure at the zoo. In addition to that, we're looking at other cost savings through restructuring. Our operations and conservation divisions in particular. There are some early retirements made possible by legislation passed last year that will allow us to realize some savings there. So in sum, the zoo does support the governor's recommendation. We believe that we can continue our recent track record of strong performance and growth at this level. Now we'll move to the request that we received from Chairman McNamara in a letter a few weeks ago, and we have prepared plans for reductions of 15% and 20% to our general fund appropriation as well. A 15% reduction equivalent is equal to about $934,000 each year, and a 20% reduction is about $1.24 million each year. Those are significant sums that the zoo could not absorb without major reductions in the quality and quantity of our products and services. Animal care, public safety, and guest experience are our top priorities. Maintaining our professional accreditation through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums is also necessary for us to continue operation. With general fund appropriation reductions of this magnitude, all of these priorities will be threatened. Again, zoo management, before cutting back in any of these priority areas, we would first look to the potential for generating additional revenue, either earned or contributed. Given the economic situation, it's going to be a challenge to even maintain the current level of philanthropic giving to the zoo, but the Zoo Foundation nevertheless is willing to step up and try to do more. But it's important to realize that increasingly, foundations and other potential givers to the zoo are interested in restricting their gifts to specific programs and specific purposes, and it's very difficult to raise unrestricted general fund support to essentially replace what had been baseline operating support from the state. On the other side of the equation, on the earned revenue side, we look at a very competitive leisure activity marketplace. We believe that the current proposed increases to our fees are probably as high as we can really go with asking the public to pay for the service that we provide. The zoo board has approved those fees, but anything beyond that I think would be inadvisable at this moment. We've implemented these fees based on the pro forma business plan that we put together as we were planning the new penguin exhibit, and it balances the new operating costs of the new exhibit with the new revenues we anticipate they would generate. This pro forma is already anticipating incremental increases in revenue from admissions and membership totaling over $2 million above this year's level of earned revenue. And so we really don't think we can, that the market would support further fee increases at this time. So, looking at cost cutting, the other side of the equation, at the 15 to 20% level, we know that that will result in a diminished product at the zoo. Zoos in general have very high fixed costs and are staff intensive by their very nature. The animal collections in our care require 24-hour care, 365 days a year. It needs to be provided by specialists and maintained by complex, fail-safe environmental systems. Currently, about 70% of our expenses are salaries and benefits, and the other significant expenses at the zoo, like utilities and supplies, are essentially fixed. We can't stop filling the dolphin pool. We can't stop heating the tropics building. We really do have a pretty, we think, a lean operation, so there's not a lot to cut on that side of the ledger. So the only way to really make major reductions is to make major reductions in our collection, eliminating exhibits that the visiting public currently experiences, and that is the kind of thing that would allow us to generate the large savings that a 15 or 20% cut would entail. We've estimated that to achieve a 15% reduction, we would need to eliminate a minimum of 10 full-time positions. Some of those savings would be achieved through partial reductions of current services. For instance, our bird show currently operates 7 days a week. We could go to a 6-day-week schedule. We do have some part-time positions in our conservation and education departments that we could eliminate without affecting the guest experience. But beyond that, a 15% cut will likely require closing one of the zoo's major exhibit areas. We have, as you know, a number of what we call trails at the zoo, the Minnesota Trail, the Northern Trail, the Tropics Building, et cetera. And it's really only by eliminating probably one of those or a couple of the others that we have at the zoo that we're going to be able to save the $1 million or so that a 15% reduction would require. We've looked at, you know, the opportunity or the possibility of evenly spreading cuts throughout the various areas of the zoo, but we believe that that would that would compromise our ability to maintain the minimum standards that are required for AZA accreditation. So again, we would instead opt to look at closing an entire portion of the zoo. We anticipate, however, that that kind of closure would have a negative impact on our attendance and our earned revenue. We know our earned revenue streams would probably start to shrink if there's a lesser product for people to view at the zoo. And moreover, although we've looked at this sort of as a paper exercise, the reality is if we're closing an exhibit, it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to deaccession the animal collection within a year, within the fiscal year. There are only certain institutions that are qualified to house the animals that we have at the zoo, and both humane regulatory and AZA regulations would really make it difficult to just simply turn off the lights on one of the exhibits immediately. The closures that we're discussing would also be problematic from a fundraising perspective. Major donors have made long-term commitments to most of our exhibits, and they would start to see the benefits of that support being eliminated. Closing major named exhibits, we think, would preclude the possibility of future support from many of our current major donors. At a 20% reduction, we estimate we would need to eliminate at least 15 FTEs, requiring the closure of all or parts of at least two major exhibit trails at the zoo. Again, we haven't determined which trails would be targeted, but areas that we've discussed include the Minnesota Trail, much of the Northern Trail, and the Discovery Bay Dolphin Exhibit. As I noted earlier, elimination of any one of these areas will negatively impact the guest experience in a pretty significant way. And we can't close attractions of that magnitude without anticipating a decrease in attendance and a decrease in membership retention. This, in turn, will reduce our earned income and lead us to probably future cost-cutting exercises. So a downsizing direction of this nature would, I think, be extremely difficult for the 1.2 million visitors who come to the zoo, our 42,000 member households, and our growing roster of donors. And that, I think this is particularly the case in light of the really positive momentum that the zoo has generated in recent years. In the past decade, we have significantly reduced our reliance on state operating support, but I think it's easy to, we've looked at the numbers, and it's just not going to be possible to continue to absorb cuts of 15 to 20% without reversing some of the great progress that we've made in this public-private partnership over the last 10 years. Now, we fully understand the magnitude of the budgetary gap that the state is facing and the difficult choices that you will all be making this session. But we do ask, however, that you consider the zoo's performance and the 180-degree turnaround that we've made in our funding model over the past decade as you make those tough decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Emke. We're going to officially bring the meeting to order. Questions for Director Emke? Director, I had one. What's the... you have a very significant, and you mentioned the foundation and the activities of the foundation board. I would imagine some of that money goes into a trust, and you only try to use the earnings and such. What's your flexibility with that money, and is some of it given with expectations or actually tails to what you can do with that money?
Mr. Chairman, the Zoo Foundation raises money really in three different pots. There is the general operating support that comes to the zoo, as I mentioned, about $1.9 million a year that helps us with our basic operations. They also raise money for an endowment, which is quite small at this point, but we began the process of building that up, and obviously the endowment funds are quite restricted in how they can be dispersed. Third, the foundation does raise money for new capital projects. So they've participated in building some of the new exhibits and are planning future exhibits. Those gifts as well tend to be restricted by the donor to that purpose, to the purpose of building exhibit X or Y. I also mentioned that many of our other operating donations are given to us with certain restrictions as well, typically to support a particular education program at the zoo, to sponsor school visits from one area of the state and the like. So I would say that majority of the funds that the foundation receives do have some level of restriction to them. That said, we're looking at the possibility where we do have options to move some of that money to help us with our general operating support. Again, I think there are some limitations, you know, how much we can grow that, given the growth that we've already experienced. As I mentioned, we've doubled the amount of private money that's supporting our operations in just the last 4 years. We'd like to see that continue to grow, but there are going to be limits to how much we can achieve in a short period of time.
Well, Director Emke, I remember in 2005 and 2006 that you were promising you were going to do great things with the foundation, and we put your feet to the fire, and I would say that you have come through like you told us when we bonded those projects that Governor Plenty strongly supported, and we did at that time, and I think you've shown how you delivered on those results, and we appreciate that. I'm kind of wondering, why do you project the attendance to drop next year? Is that something to do with all the construction going on? Or I'm surprised because you were able to hold flat this last year, almost flat. Why the projection of the decreased attendance?
Mr. Chair, our attendance is something that's generated by our finance committee, who are by their very nature conservative individuals who want to make sure, and again, the zoo does not want to overpromise and underdeliver. Given the overall economy, we have seen some softening of the marketplace for things like visiting the zoo. The construction at the zoo, we believe, may have impacted our attendance this year, and weather has certainly been a variable that was kind of out of our control but has had a negative impact over this year. Because we're not opening the penguin exhibit until July, we expect that's going to have a pretty big impact. But I think at this point, those projections are conservative, so that we don't want to end up in a situation where at the end of the year we're running very short on the operating budget. We will certainly do everything we can to exceed those projections. I'm optimistic that we will. But at this point, our board has made the determination that they want to take a conservative approach.
And Director Emke, for the members, what kind of a operating backup amount of money do you have, and how does that compare to your annual budget?
We have typically over Mr. Chairman, we've typically over the last 10 years or so tried to hold a reserve of $500,000 in an account for the exigencies of weather, knowing that our season does not correspond particularly well with the fiscal year of the state. You know, our busy season is May through September, and that breaks right on the break of the fiscal year. So knowing that we're going into a new fiscal year, we want to be sure that we're carrying enough to pay the bills. So we typically hold $500,000 in reserve. In addition, given our aging workforce, we've developed a retirement reserve in about $175,000 for the payouts that we expect as people leave the zoo. So with an overall operating budget of just under $22 million, it's actually a relatively small contingency. And again, our board has encouraged us to try to grow that over time, and we would like to, but given our operating needs, we've maintained it at the $500,000 plus the $175,000 retirement reserve.
Thank you. Question? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. If you go in the, does any zoo, just show my depth of knowledge on this, I'm sorry if I sound, this is just a common thing, but does any zoo have a internet membership where you could go on in rural Minnesota, let's pick in Crane Lake on where I live, on the internet, pay a fee with a credit card, and have access to the zoo and all the interpretive sites and see like a fly around of the zoo and see the kiosk and interact and all those things? Is that something that you do or do others do, and is that a revenue source that hasn't been investigated?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, we do have our membership program is available online, and many of our members are from Greater Minnesota. We have members from every county in the state. Their access privileges are primarily actually to come to the zoo, as opposed to special online offerings that are made available. That said, we are developing distance learning programs that will allow us to virtually visit schools, daycare centers, and the like throughout the state. We haven't yet developed a profit-making model for that. It's right now it's a service that we're providing that's been invested in by some of our donors. But clearly, as the state zoo, we do make a strong effort to reach out to the extent we can. Our Zoomobile program visits more than 50,000 people outside of the zoo every year in the state. And again, as I mentioned, our membership does include visitors from all over the state as well as people from out of state. But we, at this point, don't have what you're describing, I think, which is essentially a pay service to access the zoo virtually as a visitor.
Representative Deal.
Thank you for the follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Well, the idea actually came from my wife because, you know, she teaches up in Cook, and she said they were studying about, I think it was dolphins, or learning about dolphins, and she asked me if, you know, how do you get kids down to see dolphins from so far away? We don't have them in Crane Lake, so maybe we should, but that was something that, as you were talking, seemed like possibly at some point. I mean, we're getting pretty futuristic in all this capability and technology, and I just wondered if you could pay to be a member, and that would give you access, I mean, a school district, a family, something like that, online. I mean, everything is so online now. I'm a little online as you can possibly. You're demonstrating my capability right here doing an email. Anyway, just an idea.
Any comment, Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate the idea. And again, as I mentioned, we are trying to develop distance learning programs that would stream some of our animal exhibits and some of our educators to schools. Around. We're actually, some of that's been funded under the Legacy Amendment. So they're pilot programs that we're looking at now. But as we look at the cost structure of the equipment and the staffing, we haven't yet figured out a way to actually generate revenue doing it. It's a service, an outreach service at this point, but we'd like to look at, we want to be futuristic too, so thanks for the suggestion.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Emke, welcome to committee. Nice to have you and your guests here today. Could you describe your relationship with the Como Zoo and other zoos in the region as to whether or not you share any services or expert staff, or how you approach the establishing exhibits that may have some commonality?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson. The Como Zoo and the Lake Superior Zoo are both organizations that we've partnered with in many ways over the years, and we work cooperatively together on a number of programs. Both Como and the Minnesota Zoo are members of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and we are required as part of our accreditation under that organization to participate jointly in endangered species breeding programs and the like. So we do a number of animal exchanges and the things that have happened with the Como Zoo in particular over the years that have been part of that program. But informally, we do a lot of networking, a lot of best practice sharing. As the Lake Superior Zoo is attempting to reattain accreditation, we have worked very closely with them to help them develop the case and develop the program so that they can become back kind of in the good graces of the AZA. Obviously, we're organized differently. We're operated by different entities. Como Zoo is a city entity. We're a state agency. But that said, when there are needs that come up, we don't hesitate at all to pick up the phone and call each other or to visit. And we've sent staff from our zoo, some of our experts on our life support systems, helped Como Zoo out with some of the work when they were building some new aquariums, and we receive help from them as well. So zoos nationally and even internationally cannot exist as islands. We need to work together in order to maintain our collections. And I think it's probably, you know, we have business people who come onto our board who say that the zoo industry is probably the most cooperative and most transparent industry that they've ever seen. We work together towards a common goal, and that it certainly includes the two other major Minnesota zoos.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that.
Representative Torkelson.
Director Ramke, is there any financial exchange going on with this sharing that you have talked about? And do you get paid for the services you offer to other zoos?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, in general, no. These are things that we're doing as part of It's not on contract, on a contractual basis. It's done sort of one hand washes the other as part of a gentleman's agreement between the zoos. There are some services that we share with other entities, like the University of Minnesota, where we actually provide service to the veterinary school. We're used as an internship location, and we also use the services of the vet school for necropsies and other procedures that we can't handle in our hospital.
Thank you.
Director, thank you for coming in today. And Representative Drazkowski, I'm sorry, there's a couple here. It was actually Representative Drazkowski, then Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Emke, thanks for your presentation. And thanks for helping our Chair McNamara out on getting some projections of what you could do under those various scenarios down there. I think that'll be helpful as we move forward. One of your points piqued my interest. You talked about the fact that your operation is dependent on weather, and you've always got a keen eye to what the weather is going to be and how that may impact you. We've heard on this committee numerous times the term climate change, and we've talked to folks and even asked the commissioner of the MPCA if he knew how climate was going to change. So I thought, given your involvement in that area, I'd ask you if you might know how climate is going to change in the future.
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I would certainly not claim to have any knowledge of what the weather is going to be like when I walk outside this afternoon. So I think we'll leave that to other experts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Emke, the same response we got from the commissioner. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director MP, for being here. And I was on the tour a few weeks ago, and I don't remember what you told me as far as the number of FTEs and also the number of volunteers and volunteer hours that you get through the zoo.
Director MP.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we currently have 231 FTEs employed at the zoo. Obviously, that changes with the season. We gear up for the summer season. I believe the most recent count is we have about 800 volunteers, and these are people who make commitments not just to show up occasionally, but once a week they're coming to the zoo and spending a full day. And the value of their services, when we looked at it most recently, was well over $1 million a year in services that we otherwise couldn't be providing to our guests. They are essential to our operation. They're really, in some ways, the front line that most of our guests interact with. They help not just with interpreting the exhibits, but with making sure that a kid who scrapes his knee gets to first aid, taking care of every need that you can imagine with our guests, as well as helping our staff with our work. So kudos to our volunteers, and I hope you saw how important they are to our operation as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Director Emke, you mentioned that over the last 10 years, your level of state funding decreased from 60 down to, I believe, 29%, you said. Is that a trend that would continue, or do you feel that looking long-term, that's kind of in the range you'd like to stay in, that 29-30% level of state funding?
Director Emke.
Representative Anderson. Certainly that has been the trend, and I don't foresee that trend turning around and going in a different direction. However, if we look nationally at zoos, there are 220 zoos and aquariums that are accredited in the U.S. On average, they receive about 40% of their operating funding from public sources, whether that's from a city, a county, a special district, or a state. So we're already, as a state agency, significantly below the national benchmark for similar institutions. And so I don't foresee a time when the zoo can operate in its current state with a zero level subsidy or significantly decreased below what we're looking at now. As I mentioned, the governor's recommendation of a 5% cut will entail some difficult changes for us, but it's something we think we can weather given the momentum that the zoo's had in recent years. But at a 15 to 20% level, we're going to start to cut into the bone and reduce the product and then have a spiral effect that we think is going to be hard to get out of.
Thank you. Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just in light of Representative Drazkowski's question, I don't necessarily think we want to be asking every person who comes in here what they think about climate change, because it has unfortunately become such a political issue, although the science is pretty much agreed upon about the general trends, and a lot of the details what might happen in specific areas at specific times, that's still part of it. But the general trend of climate changing and humans being the major contributor to it, I think, is well established. And, you know, I would hope that maybe if it's still an issue, the legislature and the governor agreed 4 years ago when I was first elected, but perhaps there's been some misunderstanding as the science has gotten more clear and more certain, and maybe our committee could have a hearing on this issue after we finish with the budget. I know there's some scientists in the Twin Cities who would be interested in coming and talking about it, and I think it might be useful for this committee rather than asking each testifier who comes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Knut. I know that both Representative Drazkowski and you have interest in that issue, so maybe when time allows, someday in the future, we could deal with that. Director Emke, Ms. Edelman, thank you for coming in today. We appreciate your being there, and we look forward to working with you through these tough times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I think we have the Public Utilities Commission budget overview. Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the record, that would be good.
Mr. Chair, members, excuse me, my name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. You should have a handout. Also with me is Marcia Battles Jenks. She is the Administrative Management Director for the Commission, and also here is Mr. Dan Wolf, who is Assistant Executive Secretary. As I said, I believe you should have a handout in your packet, and in a minute here we'll get it up on the screen. Hopefully.
Well, you know what, Mr. Haar, if you would start through the handout, and Ben, why don't you phone a friend down the hallway? Thank you.
Right, very good.
All right, let's begin.
All right, very good. Thank you. I'd like to start by giving you a bit of an overview of the agency. I know some of you know us really well, and others you may not know us quite as well, so I thought that might be helpful before getting into the budget particulars. I'm looking at slide two. What does the commission do? The commission is responsible for regulating three major retail service industries that are critical to the Minnesota economy, those being electricity, the large investor-owned utilities, the larger investor-owned natural gas utilities, and local telephone providers. And the slide gives you a little breakdown as to the structure of the industry in Minnesota. Going on to slide three, the impact on the state economy stemming from these industries is substantial. The slide here gives you an indication in terms of their gross operating revenue. You can see it's a substantial amount, as well as employment. So these are really cornerstone industries that are critical to the success of the Minnesota economy. Slide four. The statutory mission of the commission is basically threefold. Our sort of bedrock statutory charge, is to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable utility services at fair and reasonable rates. Also, as of 2005, the commission received authority for approval of siting and routing of large energy facilities in Minnesota. This had previously been at the Environmental Quality Board. And in 2005, the laws, the statutory change was made to transfer that authority.
Okay, great.
Transfer authority to the commission. So that's a new, relatively new area of responsibility. And finally, the commission is responsible for fostering effective competition in Minnesota for local telephone services. As you know, telephone services are largely deregulated in the United States and as well as Minnesota. Our core functions parallel those statutory requirements, just and reasonable rates and terms of service for utility services. Slide gives you an indication of sort of the nature of the activity that we've seen since 2006. Total rate increases in the general rate case request, this would be of us a little over $600 million and actual rate increase approvals by the commission of just over $400 million. During this period, I might add that this has been a particular, and I'm going to go into a little more detail on this topic in a minute, but this has been a particularly busy period in terms of rate case activity. The level of the rate case filings has picked up substantially in recent years. Core function is energy infrastructure, approval of review of energy infrastructure that enhances the public interest. And also, the commission has a responsibility to establish broad utility and telephone policies. This is primarily done through the commission's rulemaking activities. We also are involved in resolving party-to-party disputes. This is particularly the case in the telecom industry, which is a competitive industry. And in the telecom industry, the commission is really almost more like an antitrust court as opposed to a traditional economic regulator. The companies will come before the commission with various competing issues, and the commission is charged with resolving those and adjudicating a decision. Commission also has a consumer affairs office. We field a large number of complaints a year or inquiries. The number of calls received by the Consumer Affairs Office has been rising in recent years. As of fiscal year 2010, we had about 22,600 calls to our Consumer Affairs Office, and it's projected to be larger than that this year. Our number of complaints, formal complaints that are filed that require substantial follow-up with utilities by our Consumer Affairs Office hovers right around 2,000, but that's been gradually increasing as well.
Mr. Haar, excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haar, I just had a question. We went quickly over the amount of rate increases that have been requested, and I'm just wondering why so many requests recently.
Mr. Haar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, that's a good question. We're kind of wondering that, too, but I think it's largely due to the fact that what's been happening in the economy, the economic downturn has put financial stress on utilities to meet their capital requirements. So they've been motivated to, I think, file rate cases in response to that. I think also a very substantial motivating factor are the greater requirements placed on utilities now in terms of renewable energy standards, emission requirements, just infrastructure upgrades. We are evolving away from our sort of localized service areas into regional markets. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute too. That's requiring bringing forth requirements for substantially greater transmission. Looking at transmission investments. So there are a whole variety of factors, but I would say those are probably the two major ones.
Thank you.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commission also endeavors to provide a public forum for discussion on issues of interest, topics of interest. Most recently, we've had public discussions on smart grid, something that's very much of interest in the utility area. and also we have regular conversations with the an organization called the Midwest Independent System Operator, which is this regional grid operator, and again, I'll have more to say about that in just a minute. And finally, representing Minnesota's interest in regional and national forums, and again, I'll have more to say about that in a minute as well. The structure of the commission, consists of five commissioners, no more than three from any one political party. They're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The current commissioners, current sitting commissioners are listed there, and we provided our webpage address if you're interested in getting more background on them or other myself or others at the commission. Commission is deliberately structured to have a fair degree of independent decision-making authority. It's sort of a court for utility activities.
Excuse me, Mr. Hart. Representative Chair. Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to Representative Scott's question just a minute ago with regards to regulations and mandates. My home electricity bill's gone up about 85% in the past 5 years or so. You know, if these regulations and mandates continue, can we expect, in your opinion, to see a continuation of these rate increases?
Mr. Hart. Representative, a lot of factors drive utility decisions to file rate cases. These are very capital-intensive industries, and it's true that in recent years, many of these public mandates have been a factor. But certainly what's been happening in the economy, especially in the financial markets, has had an effect. So I don't think you can point to any one, necessarily one factor and say it's going to foretell a continuation of that trend. I do think that we have some significant infrastructure issues in this country. That's increasingly recognized as an issue in terms of the transmission issue I was mentioning just a moment ago, and also there are a number of factors suggesting that we may need to start looking at different sources of generation. We need, because we have generation sources that are aging, and something needs to be done about that. And right now we're in a down economy, so that the pressure to do that isn't as great, but we have some time to look at how we might go forward on that. Obviously, renewables is one important area that we need to be looking at. There's increased conversation about alternatives, natural gas, solar. There are a whole host, and quite frankly, my opinion, this is just me talking, we need to look at all of them. We need to consider everything.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Haar. So did I hear you correctly that one of the major contributors to the increases in rates is the renewable energy standard and the utilities requirements and meeting those requirements to add renewable energy to their portfolio? Is that what you had said earlier?
Secretary Haar.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Dostrowski. I indicated that the public requirements, public policy mandates of a variety of forms are part of what's prompting, I think, utilities to have financial needs and to come forward with the rate request. It's not the single interest, the single issue. As I say, there are a whole host of factors, but that's, I would include that as well.
Follow-up. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Haar, when these utilities come forward and they're required to have wind facilities and solar facilities, what I'm hearing and reading quite extensively is that these facilities and the production of that energy is more expensive than the traditional baseload sources of energy. Is it accurate then to say that the additions to the portfolios of these utilities of the mandated forms of wind and solar in a number of these cases, or in any of these cases, I'd be interested in what you have to say about that, is contributing to the increased rates in Minnesota?
Secretary Haar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Duszkowski, as I said, there are a number of factors that are prompting utilities to come forward with rate requests. There are differences of opinion on the relative costs of one source of generation versus another, looking at all the possible cost factors. I think that's something that the Commission needs to consider and does, needs to evaluate that. We're in a turning point in our economy and in these industries, and we are in a need to look at how we're going to go forward into the future in meeting our energy needs, because our energy needs are going to continue and they're probably going to ramp up once the economy starts to rebound. And we need to be evaluating all those options in terms of, you know, the specific role of one form of generation versus another. I don't think you can say that's the one single factor, and there are significant differences of opinion on the relative cost of one firm, one source versus another.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hart, one of the factors you mentioned was transmission lines and the need to build additional transmission lines. Help me understand this a little bit better. If we are relatively inexpensive for electricity compared to our Chicago area, am I getting that right?
Secretary Hart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I believe our rates are slightly less than in Chicago area and Illinois.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems that it's in the best interest of that major market to have transmission lines that can pull electricity from this area into their area where they're losing traditional sources of power just because of age and things like that. Do we have the unintended consequence of our building more transmission lines for us, making it easier for Chicago to come in and get our electricity, and with supply and demand driving up the cost of our electricity because the demand is so high that our costs go up?
Secretary Hart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think it's a couple of comments. One is that we are increasingly going to a broader regional energy market. The Midwest Independent System Operator that I mentioned a minute ago has created a very broad, very wide regional energy market, which Minnesota is a part of. So it's not necessarily our energy or their energy anymore. It's sort of the energy in the region. That's federal policy. That's the way the industry is going. So I think we need to start, you know, thinking about it in those terms. Also, even within that context, a large part of the generation, vast majority of the generation that's provided in any given area goes to serve the load in that area. The way the system works now in the Midwest independent market. So, yes, there are exchanges across a broader region, but usually it's pretty much on the margin. It's not. You know, massive shifts. It's sort of on the margin. So, I would say that you know the risks of that you are alluding to are not as great. I guess I wouldn't quite see it that way. I think the infrastructure upgrades that we are needing to do here, and that there are again some steps to address, are largely needed to address reliability issues here in our area.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
I understand that we're talking about reliability issues in our area. What I'm asking about, sometimes the things we want to do have unintended consequences. And while it might be a good to have more reliability in our area, one of the possible unintended consequences, and I can't hear from your testimony why this wouldn't be true. If we can get electricity to Chicago easier and our electricity is cheaper, well, why wouldn't they want to depend more on our cheaper electricity than building more expensive electricity down there? When the demand is higher, the prices go up. I mean, that's maybe something that we can agree on around the table of supply and demand.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Comment. Secretary Hart.
Thank you. As I said, the vast majority of the infrastructure, the development that's occurring today is to address reliability issues. Reliability issues, quite frankly, that have not been dealt with, been overlooked, haven't been done for quite some time because of uncertainty primarily at the federal level, I think, about transmission and how it's to be dealt with, because transmission is inherently a regional phenomenon. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has now set more of a defined course on that. They've created these regional transmission organizations that are guiding that process now. And now things are starting to happen. But by and large, the focus is on addressing reliability issues in these more localized in these areas. But balancing it across the region so that we can take advantage of resources, inexpensive resources, wherever they might reside. And that means that wind generation in Minnesota, for example, could be used across the region. And there's part of the discussion at the Midwest ISO has been about the prospect of a federal energy regulatory or federal renewable energy standard that would have significant amounts of wind generation in the Midwest going to the eastern load, because that's where the load is. And that would, that has to enter into how we are planning future transmission projects. But I'm talking about planning, that's years down the road, but it's part of what's being discussed. But it's an attempt to look at reliability, to establish reliability and maintain reliability in service areas, and then also address these broader regional issues. So it's sort of a balance, sort of a mix.
Thank you. Secretary Hart, is there a limit to how far you can actually, could we move electricity from the West Coast to the East Coast? Is there no limit to how far you can move it?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. I'm probably not the best person to ask about that, but the electrical grid is some people have described it as the largest machine in the world, but it's the integrated system. And you pump into it and you take out of it. Generators pump into it and load takes out of it. And the system has to be maintained at a certain level. So to say that electrons that are generated here end up in Chicago or New York or wherever is not the correct way to think about it. It's a network. It's a system that the more that are on there, the more benefit there are, the more benefits that are realized. But it's a system that has to be maintained and balanced. And the system now, the grid system, is set up in sort of three main sectors. There's the eastern interconnection, which is basically everything from the central time zone to the East Coast. There is the western interconnection, which is everything to the west of that, essentially. And then there's Texas. Those are the three main electrical grids in the country right now. So those systems those grids are run and operated as sort of separate systems. There's some interaction between them, but it's very limited. By and large, those are the interconnections. So that would be the extent of the degree of integration between states in those areas.
Mine was more of maybe it was too simplistic of a question, but is it practical? Can you generate electricity 1,000 miles away, and will it you can transmit it on lines? I mean, from a practical standpoint, if there's extra energy being generated on the West Coast, can you actually use it through all those things you talked about to help the East Coast, or is that not a practicality?
Mr. Chair, I would say the likelihood of that scenario would be very small, West Coast to East Coast, just given the way the system is structured. Generation provides balance to the system, whatever interconnection system you're on, and going from point A to point B is rarely done. There are instances where a direct current line can go from point A to point B where it's very specific generation, very specific load. That can be done, but that's fairly limited and done usually on only a very broad scale. Almost the entire system is alternating current, AC, which is this large network I was describing to you earlier.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment briefly on the discussion we were having on rate increases, and I think Representative Fabian talked about a significant increase that he'd seen in his electric rates, and I can't remember who all was on the Energy Committee the previous 2 years, but we had a pretty good discussion of how rate increases. We had a good explanation from the PUC how rate increases are determined in that process, and it can take 12 to 18 months. And I just recall we had a pretty good discussion of that. And one of the things, and I know Representative Beard, and I wish you were here to talk about this, perhaps respond. I don't like to bring something up when somebody isn't here, but I need to respond to some of this on the rate increases. And for those of you that weren't around to hear some of it, when Representative Beard brought to us and the Energy Committee last year, the year before, we were talking about rate increases, and he brought to us a justification for these energy companies using private versus commercial airlines to get their people around. They had to do a variety of flying. And he gave us a piece of paper, and I know I filed this thing because I've got these numbers pretty close on my head. I remembered this stuff. And what the part of it that I want to bring out is that, number one, these are regulated monopolies, and there are folks that are making money off of this. So other people making a paycheck is part of your rate increases. And when Representative Beard brought that example to us, and he brought the numbers, I'm going to round things off as I remember it, but he brought the numbers. He said he had, if I remember right, it was $1,200 to, this was what it cost to fly for executives for 1 hour. Well, this is their salary part of this. That's $300 an hour for these execs. That's rounding off your $624,000 annual salary. That's part of your rate increase, what some of these folks are paid. And I just think you need to consider when we talk about this is that, you know, in a regulated monopoly, put everything on the table. We're talking about standards that we're bringing forth in policy, that most of us acknowledge that hydrocarbons are limited resources on the planet, particularly petroleum, and that we need to indeed think about the future. Another thing that we talk about, and Minnesota's leading the way, is mercury reduction. And we had the first mercury TMDL, I believe, in the country in order to help try and keep mercury out of our fish so that our women and children can eat fish in Minnesota, which now they are very restricted for eating. So those are all part of our rate increases. I just hope that you'll understand. I remiss, Representative Drakowski, that you missed some of this, but I'll talk to you offline if you want to hear some of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue, Secretary Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Commission's role is somewhat unique among state agencies. We were a quasi-judicial body, that is, when the Commission resolves party-to-party disputes, as I mentioned, quite often happens in the telecom industry, or setting specific rates in terms of service and rate proceedings and so on. The Commission functions very much as a court and has rules that govern it very much, that are very much similar to those of that govern courts. We also have a legislative function. This goes to the issue of setting broad industry policies through rulemaking. And we need to establish rules governing how certificate of need filing, for example, are going to be filed, or how consumer complaint issues are going to be dealt with. Those apply to all industries, so it's really more of a legislative function. Then the Commission also has some administrative responsibilities, has the power to investigate. Consumer complaint mediations obviously are part of that, so we kind of have all three components. Looking then to our budget, the broad overview of our budget structure is provided on slide 9. Some slide 9 here. And as you can see, it's pretty straightforward. 73% is general fund, and probably well over 90% of that is salaries and rent. Virtually all of that is recovered through the expenditures that occur under that general fund are recovered through our assessment authority. The commission has the authority to assess the utilities that come before it asking for our services, and we recover around 97%, I think it is, of our costs, excuse me, that occur under the general fund, and they go back to the general fund. We have a special revenue, a couple of special revenue funds. That, as you can see, that's about 22% of our budget. The vast majority of that is for the telephone assistance program. That's a low-income, a program that provides low-income credits low-income telephone users. Families that qualify for low-income, various low-income programs are also eligible for the PAP program if they apply for it, and they get a discount on their local telephone service if they use a landline. It only applies to landlines, not something that applies to wireless. And then also a portion of that is a revolving fund that we use for our costs for our Office of Administrative Hearings. Commission, because it's a quasi-judicial body, must make its decisions based on record evidence, and we rely a significant degree on the Office of Administrative Hearings to develop that record for us. Anytime there's any kind of a major case or major rate case or a permitting case or anything that involves questions of fact or substantial differences, we very often will refer that matter to the Office of Administrative Hearings. An administrative law judge then will conduct a proceeding to develop the record, turn it back to the commission. So we rely a great deal on their services, and we have a revolving fund to cover those costs. Those also are subject to assessment. We basically assess for those services, and those are repaid. And then we have a small one-time federal grant, ARRA grant, that's a temporary thing. It goes away at the end of this year. And we were able to acquire some very much needed electrical engineering temporary staff folks to help us on some of these transmission planning issues as part of that. But that, as I say, that goes away very soon. Looking at the budget from a slightly different perspective, this simply gives you the total dollar numbers. And I think I'll just move on to the next thing, which is what are our most pressing budget issues. Far and away, our managing our workload is the most pressing issue we have. We have one of the smallest staffs in the country, yet our workload is comparable to every other state commission that's, you know, dealing with issues that we've been talking about this morning. So that's by far and away our biggest concern. But I have more to say about that in a minute, but I do want to cite a couple of other things, too, that are important to us. Because we have such a small staff and because we have this growing and more complex workload, we have had to adopt other measures to try and deal with it. One of them is the increasing use of electronic document management and trying to be more transparent to the public. We've been very successful in developing electronic dockets and electronic filing system that our users have become very dependent on, which we are happy about. It's proven to be a very, very useful tool. We're trying to accomplish formal service among parties now electronically. We're moving in that direction. The assessment process I've talked about, mentioned a couple of times, we've developed substantial software to manage that more effectively with fewer staff, quite frankly. We've gotten into webcasting our commission meetings on Thursday morning. Anytime you don't have anything else better to do, you can sit down and plug into our webcast. The commission meets every Thursday morning, and the commission meeting is available on the Internet. That's proven to be very popular. We have a project underway to digitalize service area maps, and we hope to have a link on our website page very soon that will show you electric service territories, a digital map on electric service territories. So we're trying to provide these kinds of resources to the public, make it more transparent, make it easier to use. And part of that has been a substantial effort to upgrade our web page to do exactly that. The other item mentioned here is developing a staff for the long term. nearly 20% of the PUC staff is at or within 5 years of the rule of 90. So we have we've been blessed with low turnover, which means we have a very experienced staff, very knowledgeable staff. But at this stage, a lot of them look like me, and a lot of them are going to be gone in a while, and in a fairly short while. And therefore, it's important that we build bench strength. We've been taking steps to do that. We think we've been successful, but certainly it's something we're trying to put a lot of energy into. Regarding the workload issues, probably the most significant factor affecting operations is our sustained and more diverse and complex workload. This slide just gives you an example of this. Unfortunately, on the overhead, the years don't show up, but I believe in your handout they should show up.
Secretary Hart, they actually don't. Is it the decade of 2000?
I wonder what happened here. Anyway, yes, it is. Exactly
okay,
right.
Thank
it goes from
continue.
2000 on the left to 2009 on the rightmost column. And this just shows you four types of filings that the commission deals with: general rate cases, GRs, general rate cases, IRP is independent integrated resource plans, CN is certificate of need, and siting is siting and routing of major facilities. These are probably the four categories of cases that take the most time. They're the most complex or the most controversial. They're the things that we spend most of our time on. And as you can see, the filings in these four categories has gone up substantially during that period. You can see a fairly major ramp up in 05. That was obviously the time at which the authority for siting and routing was transferred from EPP over to the commission. So that had a pretty major impact. I might also mention that was about the same time that the Midwest ISO started to ramp up and require our attention on that front too. So this chart doesn't show everything. And the next slide goes on to talk about some of the other factors, one of which is the fact that our level of overall filings, categories beyond just these four, has also been sustained at a fairly high level. Typically 1,800 to 2,000 filings are received annually. These include things like depreciation, rate riders, mergers, service area disputes, few clause adjustments, to name just a few. And we have to manage these as well. Also, I mentioned several times this morning the Midwest Independent System Operator. This is the organization that operates the grid of which we are part. The grid, the Midwest ISO footprint runs from western Pennsylvania to eastern Montana and includes Manitoba. Far south is Missouri. So it's a huge area. And the state regulatory commissions for those states are part of an organization called the Organization of Midwest ISO States. And we are active in monitoring the activities of the Midwest ISO, participating and advising the board of directors there on issues relating to transmission planning and so on. So that's taken a huge amount of time, and a huge amount of time. That's been a major, major distraction. Some states have assigned 2 or 3 people full-time to this. We haven't had that luxury. I just want to elaborate a little bit on the fact that the factoid I mentioned a little earlier, and that is we're one of the smallest staffs in the country. if you look at us on a per capita basis, and calculate that out, Minnesota ranks 47th out of the 50 states on a staff per capita basis. And if you throw in our colleagues at the Office of Energy Security, it bumps us all the way up to 42 in the country. So we're not overstaffed here in Minnesota. And this chart shows you comparisons for a collection of states that are approximately the same population size as Minnesota, plus or minus 500,000. And as you can see, their staff sizes versus Minnesota PUC or the PUC plus the OES. So this shows you that we have a lot of work to do and we're very busy. So our initiative and our change item, which is included in the proposal, which I'm before you, is for a staff increase for expediting regulatory decision making. We need more resources to be able to manage our flow of filings, to be able to render decisions on a more timely basis. Some of you may recall that a couple of sessions ago we pursued legislation to extend the 10-month deadline on general rate cases because we simply were bumping up against that all the time. And with the legislature's help, we were able to get an extension to allow the commission discretion to extend that by 90 days. But that's the kind of measure we've had to take in order to be able to operate effectively. I think we've run out of options like that. I don't see any more on the table. So we really felt compelled to ask for more resources, and our proposal is for a $750,000 a year increase. Again, this would all be recoverable through our assessment process. And what we've planned for, if this were to come to pass, would be FTEs that would go directly to those four major categories that I mentioned to you a minute ago, the general rate cases, planning, certificate of need, and siting and routing. So that's the proposal, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for your questions, and I'd be happy to answer others if you have it.
Secretary Haar, I'm curious, the commission, you mentioned they meet every Thursday morning, so they meet year-round, and are they teleconference meetings so the commissioners can meet by phone, or are they? Do they have to be in person?
Mr. Chair, thank you. They are in-person meetings. I kind of skipped over some of the earlier business just to kind of make up time, I guess, but one of the things that the commission has to do is all its meetings have to be in public, subject to the open meeting law, obviously. But they are in-person meetings. We haven't gone to the remote kinds of participation for commission meetings, at least at this point. I understand there's some legislative authority to allow that under certain circumstances, but we haven't done that.
Secretary Haar, and as a quorum of the membership would be three members, they can do business with three members there?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And Secretary Haar, what's the salary for the commissioners?
Mr. Chair, it is currently $88,500, which I might add is about $40,000 under the average for the states of comparable size.
So it's $88,500 and it's about two-thirds the average of other states? Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The average salary for states of comparable size for commissioners, average salary is around around $112,000, I believe, at last count, somewhere in that area, $115,000, something like that.
And Secretary Haar, are they part of the state employee pension and health insurance? Do they have the good health insurance that you and I have? Are they also part of that plan?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And would they, unlike myself, are they in the state retirement plan, so they're, if this is a good position for them to have in regards to their high five, this would be a good thing if they historically were a state employee making substantially less. Are they in the state retirement plan?
Mr. Chair, I believe they are. Yes. Yes, they are. Right. I should.
That's good. Thank you. Secretary Haar, do they, in their job description, what are their duties outside of the Thursday morning meeting?
Mr. Chair, the meetings are weekly, as I said. It's a weekly meeting. We typically have in the neighborhood of, well, it varies the number of dockets. Some weeks it's it could be 15 to 20 separate items. Some weeks it's less than that. But they need to spend their time preparing for those meetings. As I mentioned, we typically have around 1,800 to 2,000 filings a year. A lot of those are routine and don't require a lot of attention, but a lot of them require a lot of attention. And their job is to prepare and read the records of those proceedings so that they're familiar with all the issues, all the public input. some of the records are very substantial. You can go on our webpage. You can access all of the public documents on all of our proceedings, and you can review them. And some of those records are very, very substantial. They take a lot of preparation time. In addition to that, that's their main responsibility.
Okay, thank you. Do they have offices at a building somewhere? Is there a state building where they have offices? And then do each one of the five commissioners have a support staff? And do each of the commissioners, generally speaking, come to work every day?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do have offices at our facilities in the Metro Square building. And they do not have individual support staff other than, you know, than our staff. They don't have individual people assigned to them, unlike the vast majority of other state commissions. Most other state commissions do. We do not. They are there on a regular basis. I mean, there are some days that aren't there, but by and large, they're there on a very regular basis, on a daily, weekly basis. Yes.
And Secretary Haar, are they, I guess I only know where one of them live, and I've never been on the Energy Committee until this year. Are they generally from the metro, or if they're outstate, how does that work? Do they come in every Thursday morning?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, well, actually, there's a requirement that at least one member has to reside at the time of appointment outside the metro area, and that member right now is Commissioner Wergen, Betsy Wergen, who lives in Cambridge. excuse me. We have had commissioners from northern Minnesota at the time of appointment, from really all over the state, but many of them live here now as because of their employment situation.
So I might have missed it, Secretary Haar. Did you say they do come to work every day?
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, they are there. Their schedule is somewhat more flexible than the commission staff members, but they are there largely every day. And they're there for meetings with the staff. And to review the documents. We have allowed them and given them technology to be able to access the record remotely so that they can review the required reading documents electronically so that, you know, they don't have to physically be present necessarily, but even with that they are there regularly.
So Secretary Haar, so unlike this job where people call us a part-time job, these would be full-time jobs. These are people that are state employees, that this is their full-time job.
Mr. Chair, I would say that it is a full-time job given their responsibilities, given the industries that they're responsible for. Okay. Regularly.
Yes. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If I could go back for a second, Mr. Haar, you mentioned you had jurisdiction in some of your power line sightings and things. My question deals with smaller transmission lines out in the country. And my question has to do with, I have a couple of small wind projects in my district that have been trying for 5 or 6 years to get up and running, and they haven't succeeded so far. And part of their issue lies with the cost of getting from their wind tower site up to a substation and upgrading that 169 kV power line up to the substation. And who pays for that, and how is that related back into a power purchase agreement? Do you determine who pays for those types of things and if those lines have to be upgraded?
Secretary Haar.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Anderson. Generator interconnection cost, which is, I think, what you're talking about, is determined by a tariff at the Midwest ISO. That's largely a responsibility that occurs under that tariff. So that's not something that we set, that we directly determine. Now, the cost of recovering those costs, if the interconnection were to occur and it were to somehow manifest itself in some sort of be included in a rate request, you know, that then we would be involved in that cost recovery part of it. But in terms of the actual allocation of the cost, that's done under the Midwest ISO tariff. Mr. Chair, if I might just mention, too, that I would strongly encourage the committee to if you have time, to have a presentation from the Midwest ISO, and we'd be happy to contribute that, but just to learn more about it, because that has such a huge bearing on what we are doing right now. big impact on our agency, but also on the issue, all the issues we've been talking about.
Thank you, Secretary. Follow-up, are you good, Representative Anderson? Follow-up, Representative Anderson.
Just one more related question. A lot of emails lately about, again, talking about wind projects and setbacks. Do you determine setbacks from adjoining land for wind towers and projects?
Secretary Hart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, we have that responsibility. The Commission has adopted the approach of setting those standards on a sort of a case-by-case basis based on decibel level and some other sort of physical kinds of indicators. We have a effort underway right now to look at perhaps trying to standardize that to a greater degree, but that is such a difficult issue, as you can imagine, because it varies from with each case, each circumstance. And the Commission is trying to be, and I think has gone to great lengths to be deferential to landowner concerns on that. But I'm sure you can imagine that's a difficult task.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haar, and thank you for your presentation. At the end, you talked about increased staff needs, and it looks like probably 8 FTE, something like that, is what you're anticipating the workload is demanding. And I'm curious, the Next Gen Energy Act, the Renewable Energy Standard, and the activity of your agency around implementing those and all of the additional activity that they bring, are those contributing significantly to those increased needs for staff?
Secretary Hart.
Mr. Chair, I would say what's happening in the electric industry across the country is what's driving this. I mean, it's you can't point your finger at any one thing. Certainly the interest in developing renewable generation in the state is a new factor, and it's something the Midwest ISO has dealt with, because we're dealing with not, you know, centralized generating stations that are, you know, in one spot you can build transmission lines to, but you're talking about dispersed generation that's occurring across a broad spectrum that you have to be able to access and bring into load. That's a huge issue. So that it's those kinds of things and the economy, as I mentioned before, that are driving these financial issues for the utilities.
Follow up, Representative Jaskowski.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Haar. So I mean, you know, if you've got a state that has say 5 baseload facilities versus one that has, you know, the equivalent in 100 small wind facilities, I would expect there's going to be more activity of your agency in order to mitigate all the things that they need to mitigate around rate setting and some of the things that Representative Anderson talked about and others. It seems that it's intuitive that's contributing. So I'm curious. I mean, if we didn't have the propagation of these other non-baseload sorts of developments that are coming out of the Renewable Energy Standard and the Next Gen Energy Act, if those weren't there propagating these, is it safe to say that we wouldn't have the level of the increased need in staff, or certainly the level of increased need of staff?
Further comments, Secretary Haar?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Piskowski. As I indicated, the Commission staff is one of the smallest in the country, and it's been that way for a long time. We're behind times on this, and the industry is changing. There's a substantial increase in the activities across the country. It's not just Minnesota. Wind development isn't an issue in Minnesota. The need to look at generation alternatives is not just an issue in Minnesota. The need to look at transmission investment is not just an issue in Minnesota. It's a regional, it's a national issue. So,
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chair, I sense that we're on a pretty fast pace. I know we got to get conservation up here. In speaking to Dr. Haar, and it's good to see you again, Mr. Dr. Haar. I want to talk about telephone versus energy issues. On page 2, you talk about the local telephone revenues and so on. Does that include this, or are you talking just about the revenues that you're responsible for regulating?
Dr. Haar.
Mr. Chair, I'm just talking about landlines.
Landlines, okay. And for the people at home, I held up my cell phone, Representative, or Mr. Chairman. In looking at these full-time equivalents, if we were to do something to lessen the regulatory load on telecom, would it be possible to transfer some of the folks who are working on that now? Do they have skill sets that would transfer to the energy side since the workload is increasing there?
Dr. Haar.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Beard. What's largely driving the request that we have before you, as I pointed out, is the need to address the workload in those sort of four major categories, none of which are related to telecom. And so I would say that that's not really what's pushing this. We have to also remember that of those 2,000 filings that we have on an annual basis, probably maybe two-thirds of those are telephone filings. Vast majority of the filings we get are telephone filings. A lot of them are routine. They aren't nearly as complicated and messy as a power plant, for example, but they're still filings, and they still have to be managed. We have reassigned some staff on a temporary basis from telecom doing specific things on energy issues, so we've already started to move in that direction. But we still need people to watch what's going on in telecom.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Haar, could you speak a little bit about the space that the PUC is housed in? Is it rented space? How long have you been there? What is it? Do you know what it costs? And is there the ability, because I believe you're a little bit separate from the third function of the Department of Commerce, correct me if I'm wrong, but just could talk a little bit about the space that's being utilized for some of these functions.
Dr. Haar, I'm going to ask you to do that and answer that in a general way, but that's a follow-up to some of the questions I asked earlier. I'm not sure if Representative Falk was here then or not, but I would like follow-up data on commission staff, where they're housed, and that kind of stuff. Dr. Haar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, we are housed in the Metro Square building. We've been there since 1992, I believe. We moved. What's our annual?
I didn't
know. Okay, we'll get that to
you. If you could get us the rental information, that'd be great.
We have 42 FTE staff people, approximately five commissioners, so a total FTE of 46.
That's good. I think you've got some information handed to you, maybe on some rent information.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I can give you the square footage. It's $1,750 per square foot, and we rental costs, right? And yep. We can get you the
and if you could let us know how that's changed as rent rates have substantially decreased in the market, we'd like to know that in regards to you. Thank you. Follow up, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to the point that, I mean, if we have state space that's not utilized and we're paying rent for additional space, maybe we can look at, as a macro view, figuring out ways to save the state a little bit of money by moving some of these functions into either unutilized space or maybe more efficient space.
I'm glad to see you act as a conservative, Representative Falk. Thank you, Dr. Haar, for being there. I would have referred you as Dr. Haar, except I didn't know, Representative Beard, you had that title, so I apologize. Mr. Price, we got you in here in the 10 minutes. So you're going to have to be short and sweet. Members, Mr. Price is with the Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa, and he's going to talk. Has a small general fund budget historically, and Mr. Price has been in here before to talk to us about the Conservation Corps and what they do. So Director, I believe. Is it Director?
Yes.
Or Senator. Director Price is a former state senator from the East Metro. Director Price, if you could let us know, concentrate on the change item in the governor's budget, and then we'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, committee members. We are required as a Conservation Corps, Len Price, Executive Director of Conservation Corps, Minnesota and Iowa. We are required by statute to provide a report of how we spent the general fund dollars that we received in the previous budget, and also the expenditure of the natural resource dedicated funds. And so we filed a report with the legislative library. You can access that online. And what I did in preparation for this meeting today was take some of the pages from that, and that was the handout that staff provided to you. And what I'd like to do, because of the shortness of time, is have you turn to page four in that handout, because it shows at the bottom of that page the use of our state funds that we have received. The 2010 participants chart at the top is a snapshot of the involvement of over 400 youth and young adults in this endeavor. Essentially what we're doing is engaging these people in job skill preparations and work. I mean, we do provide jobs and work for these individuals. So how do we take the $455,000 of general funds and the $490,000 of state dedicated natural resource funds and use them? Well, on the next page, we have outlined, this is on page 5, starting in the middle of the page, three basic explanations of how we use the general fund dollars. We use them, essentially, the general fund dollars, to cover our front end costs. We train people to do the work that we do. We have staff that we cover that need the support to be able to do this. We talked about that in our overview. We also require our staff to go out and find work, to negotiate contracts and so on with the project hosts or partners that we engage with. So those dollars are used to help generate the fee-for-service component of our revenue stream, which, as the chart at the top of page 5 illustrates, is about 52% of our budget. We have traditionally had somewhere between 48 and 54% of our budget over the years generated by fee-for-service. So in a nutshell, that's how we use those general fund dollars. The natural resource dedicated fund dollars, by statute, are restricted to certain types of work that our Corps members do. Each year we sit down with the various heads of the DNR divisions and we negotiate what they would like to have us do in a given year. And so there's dollars that are expended toward forestry, snowmobile trails, water access, and so on. That's part of the report too. I did not include that in this version that you have today, but you can get that online. My pitch here today is to say, and I think Representative Dill articulated this so wonderfully when we were here for the overview, that we are a really good investment of state dollars. We're a good investment because the return that the state gets is remarkable. It gets a group of young people who get engaged in this kind of work, who are doing work on public lands that we as a state are responsible for managing and improving. These are public lands that the public enjoys and wants to use for recreation. It makes for a greater quality of life in our state. This is a way for us to attract federal dollars. By virtue of the Conservation Corps existing, we were able to attract federal dollars through the stimulus package that came out of Washington. We have had 3 years, and we'll have one more year of work in the Superior National Forest for 40 Corps members. All of those dollars got spent locally. I signed checks for Zupp's Food Market. I signed checks for gasoline. I know that they're spending their money on rent. I mean, that's just one little example of how the dollars that are invested in keeping this operation going gets accelerated through the economy. That's a good deal for them. It's a good deal for the local. It's a good deal for our state. All of these young adults get a Pell Grant. That Pell Grant is federal money that they are going to receive once they finish their year of service. That Pell Grant can be used to go to any state college, university, technical school in America. A lot of that gets spent right here in Minnesota. That's $5,200 or $300 each year for the year of service that that Corps member uses. Most of them that don't go to work after they're done in our year of service go back to school. So that's another set of dollars that flows into our economy here in the state of Minnesota. You know, if I had my head on straight and if the state wasn't in such dire circumstances, I'd be here asking for more money, because we have grown so dramatically in the 6 years that I've been the executive director that we're really, really stressed to be able to adequately provide what we think are the training and opportunities for the Corps members that we have. We pinch pennies every place, try to keep the quality of our program going. But I'm a realist. I know that we have this problem. And I know that we want to keep these opportunities available for the young people in our state, and that it is a good economic activity. So I'm just asking here today that in the most prudent and frugal way, we will spend these dollars. The governor was kind enough to support our program and not give a cut to us in his budget. Obviously, we support that. We will do our best with the dollars that are given to us, but we want to continue to be able to provide this quality program, which is a win-win situation for everybody. Win-win for natural resources, win-win for responsible public land management, win-win for the opportunities that these young people have in our program. So given the shortness of time, if anybody would like to have more discussion about this, I am completely at your disposal for visits in your office, emails, phone calls, whatever. Mr. Chairman, I know we're just about out of time, so maybe there are some specific questions.
Questions for Director Price? Thank you. We need to approve the minutes. Representative Fabian moves the minutes. Is there discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. We're adjourned.